Have you met Mr. Trump?
Many times.
You have?
We did all the research, all the data, all the analytics, all the targeting. We ran all the digital campaign, the television campaign, and our data informed all the strategy.
Undercover tape there from Britain's Channel 4 featuring Alexander Nix of Cambridge Analytica talking about his firm's work for the Trump campaign. Nix has now been suspended by the company, which says it's launching an investigation. In a series of meetings with Channel 4's reporters who posed as Sri Lankan businessmen looking to hire Cambridge Analytica for possible campaign work, Nix and others apparently also offered other services like bribes and prostitutes. Meanwhile, Facebook stock is down again today as the company faces new scrutiny by the Federal Trade Commission about its dealings with Cambridge Analytica, and the European Union is turning up the heat. Joining us to talk about this is Elizabeth Dwoskin, Silicon Valley correspondent for The Washington Post. Hi there.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the show.
Great to have you. Okay, well, tell us more about this undercover story that Channel 4 put out about Cambridge Analytica. What have we learned from that?
Look, I think what we've learned is that it's pushed Cambridge Analytica, a company, to try to separate itself from Nix. But, you know, it looks to me like this was part and parcel of these dark arts were part and parcel of what Cambridge Analytica did as far back as 2014, 2015, when they were trying to take illegally taken data from Facebook. So I think it'll be very hard for them to separate themselves, but they have to right now because if they want to survive at all as a company, they're under investigation by the British government, and so is Facebook, and Facebook is also investigating them. And also, Facebook had an employee that they hired from Cambridge Analytica, who they're also looking into.
And Cambridge Analytica has gone on Twitter to dispute a lot of this, basically saying, look, we received data from a contractor, this professor from Cambridge University, who had launched this app to get people to fill out a quiz to, you know, and then he called their sort of personalities from there to predict how they would vote. They basically say, look, once we got that information from him, we deleted it after Facebook told us the contractor had breached their terms of service. Is that true?
We don't know. Facebook seems to think that it was not deleted after Facebook told them to delete it in 2015. But yes, they are towing a line that they just got the data from a contractor. However, the whistleblower, David Wiley, said that the whole contracting situation was set up specifically to get data for Cambridge Analytica. It wasn't that he just created an app and then later Cambridge approached him. No, the whole thing was done in concert by design.
Okay. And so they are under investigation, or Facebook, I should say, is under investigation right now by the Federal Trade Commission for perhaps breaching an agreement that said that they weren't going to do this. Basically, an agreement that said that they would protect users' privacy. What did that agreement say, and how would they have violated it with this?
So there's a lot of issues to this agreement, and this will be a really interesting investigation because it actually gets to the heart of Facebook's core business, though they'll tell you over and over again that it doesn't, but it does. Facebook went under a consent decree in 2011 with the Federal Trade Commission, and part of that agreement that they signed was agreement to 20 years of monitoring, and they were not allowed to make changes to how Facebook users' data was going to be used or shared in any way without notifying them and getting their permission in any way that went beyond the privacy policies. But what happened after that is that Facebook responded by making their terms of service really broad and sometimes not entirely clear. At the time that Cambridge Analytica was siphoning data from Facebook, if you downloaded an app from Facebook, you may remember this, or if you used Facebook login to sign into a website, you know, login with Facebook, you do that everywhere. So apps were using that to collect not just the data of the people who logged in, but also their friends. And that was widely allowed under Facebook's policies until 2014, 2015. Facebook restricted it, announced that they were going to restrict it in 2014, and actually blocked third-party developers from getting the friends' data in 2015. But Nix and Cambridge were taking the data before that policy restriction, that restriction actually happened. So at the time, any developer, not just Nix and Cambridge, but any developer, and I wrote yesterday in my story, even Barack Obama's presidential campaign was making use of the API, not just to get the data from the people who logged in or who downloaded the app, but also their friends' profiles. And we're talking about all their friends' likes, their friends' photos, people who never actually logged in or downloaded the app. But, and here's the question. When you or I would download a Facebook app or log in with Facebook, we would see a screen of permissions before we actually downloaded it that this app wants to take blah, blah, blah information from you, your birthday, your relationship status, your likes. And it also is going to take some of your friends' data. And then you say, okay. But what seems weird about that in retrospect is how are you consenting to giving away your friends' data?
Right.
Which was exactly their consent screen. So it'll be very interesting to see whether that was actually enough. Facebook will probably say, and they've said to me, that the FTC was reviewing their privacy policies at the time. So the FTC and a lot of privacy advocates have been calling the FTC weak on this for years, specifically on the friends' data issue. So it'll be fascinating to see it being revisited.
So it seemed like this is part and parcel of like the new political environment, that this is how campaigns are being waged now.
Right, which is why it will be fascinating, because if the FTC finds this problematic, you're talking about thousands and thousands of developers who took friends' data.
Right.
Not just Cambridge Analytica. What Cambridge Analytica did was they hired another person to pose as a psychologist and do a research study. So they said they were taking the data for a different reason than they actually took it for. So that's deception, and that was completely not allowed. But what a number of people have said to me, including people who worked on the Obama campaign, was if they had just gone and posed as Cambridge Analytica, they probably could have gotten the very same data.
So meanwhile, where is Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg? They haven't exactly been making a lot of public statements.
They haven't. And they've just today, there was a town hall meeting at Facebook, a company-wide meeting, and they didn't show up. They had their vice general counsel do the meeting. And then when people pressed them on it, they said Facebook is... Mark and Sheryl are working round the clock, as you can imagine, to get to the bottom of this. It looks like they don't have an answer. And, of course, there are calls for them to testify now by many members of Congress. And I think they're waiting on the chair of the Judiciary Committee, Grassley, to really be the one to say, to call for them to testify. Now, these companies do not want to testify, and certainly Zuckerberg does not want to testify. I know he's very afraid to do that from several sources.
But the European Union wants him to testify. As well.
Europeans want him to testify. The U.S. wants him to testify. His employees want to hear from him. This is probably, you know, just as big as the Russia scandal. This is the biggest conflict that they've gotten into in their history as a company.
So I guess he's not going to go on a listening tour, another listening tour for a while.
Another listening tour, exactly. Last year he said, you know, there might be some issues with Facebook. We want to, you know, listen to America. And he puts himself on a listening tour of 50 states. And this year, that was his New Year's resolution. And then this year, his resolution is to right the ship that is Facebook. But it's turning out to be a lot more complicated, I think, than any of them thought. You know, I think everyone on the executive level at Facebook believes their personal mission to right the ship. But a lot of darkness has to come up and get uncovered before that ship can be righted, if it can be at all.
Elizabeth Dwoskin, Silicon Valley correspondent for The Washington Post. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, the end of the Weinstein Company and what that means for the women suing it. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's official. The Weinstein Company is finished. The studio has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection and announced plans to sell off its assets to a private equity firm. Even before the Harvey Weinstein story broke last fall, the company was having financial problems. Since then, it's only gotten worse. Investors fled, and women alleging abuse filed lawsuits against the company. Well, those lawsuits are now on hold, but women who were forced to sign non-disclosure agreements are now free to tell their stories. With the bankruptcy filing, these NDAs are now moot. Kim Masters is editor-at-large of The Hollywood Reporter and host of KCRW's The Business. She's here now. Hi there.
Hi, Madeline.
All right. So talk to me about this provision making all the NDAs moot and ineffective. Is that a common thing to do?
No, I mean, this thing I have to tell you is just such a hot mess that the impact of that is not even clear. I mean, what we have is a situation, as you said, where the Weinstein Company was finally pushed into bankruptcy. It took longer than many people expected. There's a company called Lantern Capital out of Texas that's offering $310 million, but that is like what they call a stalking horse bid, the loan number, saying that if anybody else wants to buy the assets of the Weinstein Company, they have to come in with more money than that. So there will be a kind of an auction. Meanwhile, Eric Schneiderman, the attorney general in New York, has sued because of alleged violations of people's civil rights and harassment and trying to get some restitution. That is still a pending case. And this non-disclosure release that they have given to their employees, it's not clear that this applies to all of these women, and there are dozens of them who came forward against Harvey Weinstein, because it's not totally clear whether all of these were Weinstein company agreements or whether some of them were Harvey Weinstein personal agreements.
Mm.
So this would presumably liberate employees at the company to say what they saw or knew or what kind of bad experiences they had. And it's kind of funny because, you know, there's been a lot of speculation who knew what when. This is something that the Attorney General in New York wants to also know, who enabled this, who allowed this. So in a way, this could shine a spotlight on people who work there who have held their silence because they all had non-disclosure agreements as a matter of course. Now people will be sort of are already saying, well, it sure would be interesting to hear what this person has to say who worked there. I would like to know what went on there. So it opens the floodgates maybe more for employees at the company, not necessarily for the women.
Yeah, and Schneiderman was welcoming this. He called it a watershed moment for efforts to address. I guess so he would maybe subpoena some of these employees to testify?
Yeah, I mean, he could. It's just so unclear. You know, the bad thing for the bankruptcy from the point of view of the alleged victims is that they are back in the line behind other people who are owed money by the Weinstein Company or have claims. So what Schneiderman had tried to do initially was to sort of allow them to sell the company to this group that wanted to buy it. It was a kind of an odd offer, seemingly very high, like around $500 million. But Schneiderman was willing to let that happen under certain circumstances, with certain conditions, just so that women who are trying to get money, you know, compensation for their alleged victimization, would be able to. Now, the bankruptcy doesn't help them, but it's just very unclear still to us, how does the Schneiderman lawsuit trying to help, you know, ensure that certain bad actors at the company don't get money and ensure that women, people who work there now are protected and ensure that victims get paid, how does that, you know, function alongside of this bankruptcy? I mean, I really do think this is one of the hottest messes I've seen in a long time covering Hollywood.
Yeah, right. And so just to be clear, they're not necessarily going to get their money, these women filing lawsuits, because they have to just stand in line behind a long list of creditors, right?
Right, not from the Weinstein Company. I mean, they can chase Harvey. You know, meanwhile, Harvey himself is a complaint pending against the company for firing him. So everybody's suing everybody, and the lawyers, you know, will do very well. Although I will note the Weinstein Company owes a lot of money to lawyers.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. And then meanwhile, there are criminal investigations in New York, as we mentioned, and also in Los Angeles.
And London, yeah. And the New York situation has become sort of interesting because the Time's Up group asked the New York governor to look at Cyrus Vance Jr., who did not pursue a law, a case against Harvey, the district attorney. You know, he has not pursued a number of cases now against Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner, when there were recommendations and others. And that does seem to coincide with contributions to his campaign fund. So now the governor is saying, is asking the attorney general to take a look at Cyrus Vance Jr. and why Harvey Weinstein wasn't pursued back when the Italian model actress wore a wire and got him on tape after he had allegedly assaulted her. So this thing is just like spinning, but if I were Harvey, I would stay out of a number of those jurisdictions.
Well, where is he now?
We think he's in Arizona still. He's you know, people have sort of been trying to figure out, where is Harvey? He was supposedly at this sort of rehab facility where he seemed to not be very giving very concentrated efforts to his to rehabilitation of whatever he claims to have wrong with him. And he apparently just is sort of spotted around. There was one video that went online of someone smacking him in a restaurant and yelling at him. So he gets recognized, and I imagine he's not having a tremendous amount of fun.
No, I don't think so, and won't for quite some time. Okay, so this means that whatever projects the Weinstein Company had going, those are all, you know, not going to happen?
They're in suspended animation. The Weinstein Company has television things, notably Project Runway. But the name is so toxic right now. They have a library with movies like Lion, Django Unchained, and others. A lot of movies maybe that you haven't heard of, some that have not yet been released. They've been really desperately, you know, there were all kinds of stories of them not being able to pay bills for quite a while now, and they appear to be pretty broke. So they're in trouble, but they do have some assets. But then again, anything that has the name Weinstein on it, the name is getting erased. So there's a lot of stuff that's kind of in suspended animation, and a question of who is even going to want to be perceived as doing business with the Weinstein Company.
Kim Masters, editor-at-large of The Hollywood Reporter and host of KCRW's The Business. Thank you, Kim.
Thank you.
Okay, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia is in the United States. As you may have heard, he's on a big charm offensive. He's in D.C. today meeting with the president.
I just want to welcome you. It's a great honor to have you back again. Some tremendous things have happened for you since your last visit to the White House, when you were the Crown Prince, and now you're beyond the Crown Prince. So I want to just congratulate you. I thought your father made a very wise decision.
The Crown Prince will sit down with congressional leaders and corporate ties from Apple, Google, Uber, some big defense firms, too. But he's also making an entrance on the world's red carpet, Hollywood, that is. Turns out Prince Mohammed bin Salman is quite the cinephile. The kingdom recently lifted a 35-year ban on movie theaters, and the Crown Prince wants to invest billions of dollars in the entertainment industry. Here to tell us more about what that could look like is Brent Lang, senior film and media editor at Variety. Hi, Brent.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, well, tell us more about this vision that the Crown Prince has to bring Hollywood to Saudi Arabia.
Yes, well, with the lift of this, three-decade ban, the Crown Prince is ushering in what he hopes will be a very vibrant and fruitful and lucrative exchange with Hollywood, one that could ultimately lead to Saudi Arabia having its own kind of in-house film industry.
So it has no film industry to speak of right now.
You're basically starting from scratch. It's a very conservative country. It's a country where any kinds of movies that are being seen are either being seen kind of illegally or in the home or with the well-to-do, the well-heeled going to other neighboring countries to actually check out films. So the idea here is that there's some opportunity to have the money that that is going to other countries come to Saudi Arabia now.
Right. And so there will be some restrictions because, as you say, this is a very, very conservative country. For example, Lebanon banned Wonder Woman because the actress, lead actress, Gal Gadot, is Israeli. Would we see similar bans on Western movies?
I think the thought is that's very much a possibility. I mean, this is a country where women were only able to drive as of, I think, September of last year. So I don't think, 50 Shades Freed is going to be screening in Saudi Arabia anytime soon. And it's probably going to be a lot of family films, things like that, that aren't particularly controversial and aren't very politically charged.
And then the theaters themselves, would they be segregated, sex segregated?
That's one of the things that's being determined. I think that the thought is that they would actually probably be, but there's so many, you know, issues that have to be worked out and are being worked out. For example, it's still unclear to a lot of Hollywood studios who exactly will be doing the censoring, you know, what board you'll have to go through and what the requirements may be.
And so what's in it for Hollywood? Why would they be interested in doing this?
Money is in it for Hollywood.
Like a lot of money?
A lot of money. And it comes actually as China, which was seen as you know, a major source of funding for the film industry, is limiting its entertainment investments, cutting way back on that. So enter Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has announced that they want to invest up to $64 billion in entertainment, and that's very broad. That also includes things like sports and other kinds of entertainment forms. But of that $64 billion, my sources are telling me about $10 billion is being earmarked for film and fine arts. And what that could manifest itself as is some kind of slate financing where Saudi Arabia, through the Saudi Film Council, invests in you know, a whole range of upcoming major studio releases. And in return, they would probably ask for studios to share some kind of expertise so that they themselves, the long-term goal of this whole thing, is that they'll be able to internally produce films that will resonate with their audiences and reflect their values too.
Well, is anyone in Hollywood balking at this, saying, look, Saudi Arabia has a history of human rights violations, it's waging a very brutal war against Yemen. So is anyone saying, look, this isn't okay for us?
You know, it's interesting because in Hollywood, ethics and morality seems to be very flexible when checks are being written. So I haven't heard a lot of people raise those kinds of concerns. I think right now there's a lot of optimism. I'm not saying that there won't be some kind of blowback. I think you are looking at a country that's done some very controversial things, to say the least, in recent years. And you know, definitely does have positions that are out of the mainstream with American society. So I could see some kind of pushback here. But right now, I think folks are looking at this as an enormous opportunity. Where there was no market, there's a market that some project could, by the year 2030, be one of the top 10 markets for film.
Hmm. Well, you know, meanwhile, the Crown Prince has gone on an kind of a purge of other princes. He's arrested 11 of them, including this billionaire who's been called the Warren Buffett of Saudi Arabia, Prince Al-Waleed, and he has invested in Hollywood properties. So is there, you know, is there some kind of, I don't want to say hypocrisy, but are there some challenges there?
Well, I think there's a lot of challenges. I mean, for example, one thing that I've heard from people is that they will go to Saudi Arabia, they will have meetings with the Crown Prince or his representatives, and they will basically emerge from that meeting thinking, I have the green light to, you know, build a movie theater. But apparently other people are sort of saying, well, not exactly. And so it's unclear, do people actually have permission? Have they actually been granted permission? It's an autocracy that's also very bureaucratic. And I think folks, much as they did in China, are struggling right now to make sense of this very new landscape.
So what lessons have they learned from dealing with China?
Well, one thing I think they've learned from dealing with China is that this kind of idea of dumb money, which is something that Hollywood always was eager to exploit, is fading, and that new investors are not interested in just being passive investors. Countries like China and Saudi Arabia are looking to get something larger out of their investment. They want Hollywood expertise. They're not just looking for culture that they can import. They're also looking to develop their own internal culture that they can eventually export.
And why isn't China investing as much in Hollywood properties anymore?
I think there's a number of reasons. There's some larger sort of internal political issues that are going on there. There's also a sense that the return on their investment was not what they had hoped. I think there's some sense that maybe they were taken to the cleaners on a few of their acquisitions. And it's just a market where I think a lot of people went in, they made partnerships with great fanfare, and then the money never really seemed to appear for a lot of places.
Brent Lang, senior film and media editor at Variety. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, why black boys aren't doing as well as white boys, no matter what their family's income is.
Black boys have much lower chances of climbing the income ladder than white boys. But what's more, they actually have much higher chances of falling down the income ladder, higher levels of downward mobility than white boys.
But that is not the case for black girls and white girls. That story is next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The effects of racism might be worse than we think, particularly for black men. New research shows that black boys raised in the United States, even in the richest neighborhoods, still earn less money when they grow up than white boys of similar backgrounds. It is not the case for women, though. Black and white women usually track together, while black men rarely make it to the same levels as white men. Stanford economist Raj Chetty co-authored the study. Welcome.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Well, you tracked 20 million kids and their parents across the United States, and you found that white boys who grew up rich are likely to stay that way, but black boys just aren't. Can you explain what you found?
Well, so what we did in this study is looked at 20 million kids who were born in the late 1970s, early 1980s, and tracked them to look at how they're doing today relative to their parents. So we look at inequality and racial disparities, not at a single point in time, but basically asking, what are your chances of achieving the American dream of climbing the income ladder by race? And what you see is a really striking pattern, which is that black boys have much lower chances of climbing the income ladder than white boys. But what's more, they actually have much higher chances of falling down the income ladder, higher levels of downward mobility than white boys. And so this pattern of constantly falling backwards across generations, unfortunately, leads to persistent racial disparities in the U.S. And tackling the lack of mobility for black boys in particular really seems central for reducing racial inequality in America.
So you say that there's basically a 50-50 chance if you're a black boy who grows up in a rich area and to rich parents, there's a 50-50 chance that you'll either stay where you are or you'll fall to the bottom.
That's right. Black boys have almost about the same chances of falling to the bottom, if not slightly higher, than staying at the top if they were born in a rich family. In contrast, white boys born to families, say, in the top fifth of the income distribution, are five times as likely to stay there as they are to fall to the lower end of the income distribution.
And it doesn't matter where these kids are growing up?
Well, what's striking is we looked across the United States at 70,000 different neighborhoods and asked, you know, what are the places in America where we see better outcomes for black boys and smaller gaps? And the depressing and startling finding from that is that in 99% of the places we looked, you continue to see significant differences between black and white boys' chances of climbing the income ladder.
So basically,
this is
nowhere.
Essentially nowhere, but it's important to note that there is variation in the size of these disparities, and there are a small sliver of places, some places in Maryland, for example, like Silver Spring or Queens in New York, where you see smaller racial disparities. And so you can ask, what can we learn from those areas? And the pattern you find is that these places tend to have relatively low poverty rates, high rates of black father presence in the home, so lots of kids were growing up in two-parent families, and low levels of racial bias among whites.
And then interestingly, you found that there was no disparity, or virtually no disparity, between white girls and black girls.
That's right. We were quite surprised by that. So a very strong pattern in the data is that if you compare kids growing up in families with similar incomes, white girls and black girls have very similar outcomes. They have similar levels of earnings. They have similar wage rates. They go to college at similar rates. So across a broad variety of outcomes, it seems like black girls and white girls, if they grow up in families of the same income level, are doing roughly as well as each other.
And black women have higher college attendance rates than white men?
That's right. This is controlling for family income. If you're looking at two kids growing up in families at the same income level, a black girl is more likely to attend college than a white boy.
So how do you explain this difference between black boys and black girls?
You know, one theory is that this is about issues related to racial discrimination. Perhaps there are stereotypes associated with black men that lead them to face additional challenges and make it more difficult for them to climb the income ladder. Another set of theories relates to the issue of having role models and a father presence. So we see, as I'd mentioned before, that in communities where there are more male role models, that's one way to think about it, you see better outcomes for black boys. So while we don't know exactly what cause and effect is here, that suggests perhaps that programs like My Brother's Keeper, for instance, programs that try to mentor and help black boys, show them pathways to better outcomes, provide support, could be another thing that helps boys in particular, maybe less important for girls.
So I guess what you're saying is that all of these interventions, any ways to reduce educational disparity in the schools or affirmative action programs don't necessarily work to the extent that we might want them to, that it seems like what you're saying is there's something kind of more ineffable about it, that there is racism, basically, and how do you attack racism if that's at the root of this?
What I think you learned from the study is simply creating physical integration, which is what a lot of people traditionally think of, is perhaps a step in the right direction, but it's not enough by itself. We need to think about what to do in addition.
And did you track the differences between immigrant African Americans and native born?
We did not. I think, and in particular for blacks, we didn't focus on that. We do find for other groups, for instance, for Asians, there are quite significant differences between the outcomes of immigrants and kids born here. So Asians, for example, among immigrants, you see really high rates of upward mobility. For kids born to mothers, kids born to U.S. citizens, you see rates of upward mobility comparable to whites. So there are important differences between immigrants and non-immigrants. I think we could potentially learn from that going forward.
Another positive finding from your study, Hispanic Americans moving up the economic ladder across generations.
That's right. So Hispanic Americans currently, if you look at people, say, in their 40s or 50s, Hispanic Americans have incomes roughly comparable to black Americans. But what's interesting when you look at Hispanics from this perspective across generations over time, you see that they are steadily climbing the income ladder, where Hispanic kids, they're higher up in the income distribution than their parents were, and their rates of upward mobility across generations seem relatively close to whites. So a very different picture.
And why is that? Any reason?
My sense is the legacy of racial discrimination and segregation and the factors that African Americans in the U.S. have faced are very different from the factors that Hispanics have faced. And so it's consistent with the idea that these entrenched factors have led to a particular equilibrium of outcomes for black men in particular that does not apply to Hispanic men or women or black women.
Raj Chetty is an economics professor at Stanford University, co-author of a new study on race and economic opportunity in the United States. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, a woman who is trying to find out who her sperm donor dad is.
Growing up, it wasn't even a thing. It was just like when people asked where my father was, I would just say I didn't have one. And so I wasn't really like in the market for a dad, but I was very curious. Mostly, I mean, honestly, probably being mixed, I was really curious what he looked like.
Why there are few rights for the children of sperm donors. That's next on Press Play.
Hey,
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. As a child, Courtney McKinney didn't know her dad was a sperm donor until she was 16 years old. She grew up with her mom, who's Black. And because her mom said there were no Black sperm donors back in 1989, she picked a white guy. Well, now at age 28, Courtney wants to know more about her dad and his background, and she's gone on a quest to find him. She's discovered, though, that it's hard for kids born from sperm donation to get information about their dads, even in this age of easily available genetic testing. And Courtney McKinney joins me now. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Well, how did you find out that your father was an anonymous donor? How did you get that information?
So when I was 16 years old, my mom sat me down and showed me a video she had made when she was pregnant with me that explained that my father was an anonymous donor, and that there was no way for me to get in contact with him. And that was a decision she had made because at the time it felt like the right thing for her to do.
The right thing for her to do, what do you mean by that?
I guess instead of, you know, finding a random person or something, this felt safe because she was going somewhere where she knew the donor would have been tested for diseases and all of these things. And, you know, the form that we have said that he was studying to get a graduate degree. And so, you know, it's kind of like it's a quality sperm, I guess.
And she told you that there were no Black sperm donors?
Correct.
Is that true?
As far as I know, I haven't really pressed it. And when I mentioned it to the California Cryobank, when I called them, I think the second time, they didn't dispute it.
Okay. And you called them up and you wanted to find out what?
Well, the first time I was really hopeful that, you know, they would contact my donor and he would be open to contact. I mean, I guess I was naive in that. And so I was 19 and, you know, I got in contact with the cryobank and I got a caseworker assigned. And, you know, a few days later, she called me back to say that she had had a conversation with my donor and she had remembered him from the 80s. And that they had this hour-long conversation. He was very kind, but he has a family and never told his family that he did that. And so he wasn't comfortable with contact.
Hmm. But you want to know more because you feel like you need to know more about your background?
Yeah. And I mean, at that time, I just had never even considered that I could have a father. Growing up, it wasn't even a thing. It was just like when people asked where my father was, I would just say I didn't have one. And so I wasn't really like in the market for a dad, but I was very curious. Mostly, I mean, honestly, probably being mixed, I was really curious what he looks like, especially when I was very young. And then kind of the older I've gotten and the more I've gotten to know my personality, the more I really am just curious about who he is as a person, because there are so many parts about myself that don't necessarily come from my mom. And I just have become increasingly curious over the years.
Like what? Like what do you think may come from him?
So one of the things that they said he was a psychotherapist, and I am a writer, and I tend to have friends who are therapists, which I find hilarious. And I'm just I'm a really observant person, and I really am very interested in how humans work and what makes us tick. And, you know, one of the things that I find interesting is if that's true that he was a psychotherapist, you know, that I wonder if he ever considers, you know, the psychological implications for the children he created that way.
So it's more than one child.
Yes, I found a sister through online DNA testing last year.
Oh, and what was that like?
Oh, it was amazing. I mean, so the second time I had contacted the cryobank, they told me that there were no, because I tried to get on the donor sibling registry through them and I didn't find any siblings, and they told me that there were no offspring from that donor. So I had kind of just, you know, put that aside, like, okay, I don't have any siblings unless he has his own kids. But then online DNA testing, you know, I matched with a woman in Arizona, and I actually went out there in January so we could get an actual, like, confirmation DNA test that we're half siblings, and we are. And it's been, I mean, just having that 180 from thinking that I didn't have another sibling to having this woman who's incredible. And we're so much alike. We look alike, but we're also just, she's, I just immediately feel connected to her. And, you know, we have kind of interesting similar backgrounds too. So the nature versus nurture question is kind of muddled. It's unclear, you know, the reasons we're so similar, but I just feel really blessed that it's just a huge gift, I feel like, to have her.
Hmm. And is she also biracial?
Actually, yes.
Wow.
but Latina.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. And around your same age, I guess.
5 months younger than me.
Huh. And so now I guess you're like sisters. You talk and you're close and...
We text. I think it's going to be interesting to see how our relationship develops. But we both very much feel blessed by it and want to have a relationship. And so for me, it's just like, as a person who was an only child growing up, I have no path of how to do this. I'm just kind of winging it.
And does she, your sister, does she also want to find out who your dad is?
Not as much as me. For whatever reason, it's just been something that is on my heart specifically.
Huh. Okay, so the broader implication here, or what you're trying to get across, I think, as well, is that there should be more protections in general in this industry for the offspring of sperm donors.
Definitely. I mean, so the last time I contacted the cryobank so 2 years ago when I was 26, I asked just, you know, for any medical information, any updated medical information. And they told me that's not possible. There isn't updated information. But they did give me the form that my donor filled out in 87. But he was 28, too, when he donated. And so, you know, a lot happens in 28 years. And I don't know anything about, you know, medical issues he's had, psychological issues or anything like that. And I feel like at the very least, that's what kids do deserve. I mean, people compare it to closed adoptions. And I just feel like since this is intentional, you know, people are intentionally going into the situation where a lot of times in adoption, people are trying to make the best out of a situation. I don't think we should intentionally create people who don't have access to, I think, vital information about their parent.
Is it possible to get that vital information without finding out who he is? Like, could he provide all the medical information that you need without actually telling you who he is?
Yeah, but it's totally voluntary. Like, it's up to him. He would have to contact the cryobank of his own volition and just give them whatever information.
So could the cryobank contact him, act as the intermediary to get that information?
I mean, they've told me, when the last time I contacted them, they told me they're not going to contact him again because they're not going to keep doing it. And they contacted him once and he... said he didn't want contact.
Are there places where this does happen, where the offspring are able to get this information, this medical history that they need?
Yeah, I mean, some of the sperm banks actually have a preference for open donors. And I believe the range is like completely open. So like when a person turns 18, they have, you know, complete access to the person. And then, you know, the range goes to just kind of like having updates to completely anonymous, but it's really just up to, again, it's up to the individual cryobank to decide like what they offer their, consumers.
Right. And so I guess also in Europe, they have different standards, right? It's more along the lines of adoption.
Yeah. I mean, it's country by country, but the UK, for example, banned anonymous donors, and, you know, Australia, I believe Italy. So there are countries that ban anonymous donors and specifically like require updated medical information. And I think that seems like the least that could be done.
So you mentioned earlier that because your dad is a psychotherapist, that he should have a better understanding or more sensitivity for the kind of psychological ramifications of what happened and how that's affected you. How does it affect you psychologically?
I'm still unpacking that with my therapist, but ultimately I think, you know, not having a male presence that was consistent and very present in my life has definitely had an impact on my relationship with men and learning how to allow men close to me and to trust them. And, you know, it has been a benefit because I am independent just like my mother. But at the same time, like I said earlier, there are things that I'm very different from her on. And I feel like, you know, to find out who I am, it would be very helpful to know what parts come from him. And, you know, how I could be my best self in that way.
Hmm. And so what do you do now? Like, what is your next move?
Keep living, keep writing my observations.
Finding him, or is there any way to sort of keep going with your,
I think I'm kind of at a wall, you know, yeah. Like there's not much more I can do besides I'm on all the DNA registry sites. So
maybe he might hear this or hear about you and reach out.
Yeah. And I also wonder, you know, one day one of his family members might take one of those DNA tests. It just kind of seems inevitable.
Oh, yeah. So then you could find out that way.
Yeah.
But you have your number, right? So you could.
I do. Yeah.
You could sort of publicize that if you're a sperm donor number, whatever. Please contact me.
I didn't think about that, but yeah. I could.
Well, if he's listening, what is your number? Do you want to say?
Sure, it's 1047.
Okay. 1047 if you're out there. You know what to do. All right, Courtney, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Courtney McKinney. She recently wrote an op-ed about her experience for the LA Times called "My Father Was an Anonymous Sperm Donor. I Feel the Consequences of That Every Day." Okay, Christian Bordahl is here to round out the show. Hi there.
Yes, I thought that interview was so interesting, and it brought up a bunch of questions for me.
Uh-huh.
Just like, what would you do if you donated a sperm or egg and you found out there was a child out there all of a sudden with your genes? And if you did donate and a child does end up being born, like, do you have any responsibilities at all? So I asked our listeners what they thought about that. Daniel Beeman says, and he kind of represented the prevailing attitude on this. He said, no, you don't have any responsibilities. Just because you're willing to share a gift at life doesn't mean you want to be a father or a dad, just that you care enough to help someone else to achieve that dream. Cynthia Lasley says, I think that she does deserve a complete medical history, but the donor deserves the contract he entered on when he donated, which is anonymity.
Mm-hmm.
And Identity Crisis agreed with that. He said, I clicked no in the quiz. I'll get to that in a moment. But I do feel the person donating is somewhat responsible, but just on the DNA level, meaning there's stuff in there, genetic conditions and whatnot, that could affect the person being born, and the donor should be out of his life, but available just in case. So the quiz Identity Christ mentioned, or the Twitter poll, if you donated to a sperm bank, should you have any responsibilities as a parent if a child is born? 86% said nope, only if you want, you should be able to stay anonymous. 4% said yes, you're a dad. There's a real live human out in there in the world with your genes, step up. And then 10% said, wow, that's a tough one. I don't know how to answer that question.
It is a tough one. You know, I did an interview several months ago, I think it was aired back in July, with a woman who wrote a book on this topic called Scattered Seeds. And she interviewed a bunch of people who had actually found their sperm donor dads. And she interviewed them, and she interviewed the dads as well. And oftentimes the dads were pleasantly surprised and happy to have these kids in their lives. So it wasn't necessarily a negative that they were found out. They were surprised, happy. Some participated in their kids' lives, others did not. But I thought what was really interesting was that there was this obvious link between the kids and the dads.
Like that's what makes it interesting,
huh?
Yeah, exactly.
One kid was really into math and engineering, and he was raised by an artistic mom, and he had no idea where that came from. He met his dad, who was also an engineer.
Which I think is why people are naturally curious, you know? Like, what would this person be like that is sort of part me? you know?
Absolutely.
So I did ask about, like, if you were a sperm or an egg donor and you found out there was a child out there with your genes, would you want to know that child? And about 18% said, no, that's too crazy. There's too much uncertainty. I don't know what would happen. 14% said, yes, absolutely, I'd want to. 48% said, maybe, if they want to. And 20% said, I have no clue what I would do in that situation.
Okay.
And I don't either. That's a tough one. It would be really tempting to want to know, like, who this person is and what they turned out like.
All right. Christian Berdahl, thank you so much. Thanks
sure.
for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow.